Yeah, good morning to everybody. We'll be starting our class today on the topic of being Hanukkah in just about a minute or so. And we'll just do a brief audio check to make sure everybody's picking up the audio stream properly. So once you hear the audio, please type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That will confirm for us here that you're picking up the audio properly. And again, we'll start in just about 1 minute. Good morning, Cal. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Doing okay today, thank God.
Good. Dennis is also with us.
Who's that?
Dennis Cohen from Seattle.
Dennis in Seattle.
Hello, Dennis. How are you?
Dennis.
Oh, Janice. Okay. Okay, so we wanted to take up today. I decided we'll do something on Hanukkah, since it is Hanukkah. And but more than that, there's a primary lesson that I hope we'll derive from a couple of cases in prophets that go along with a theme of Hanukkah. And the first, and they all have to do with temple, of course. Now, there's three cases we'll discuss. The first case is, of course, we know Hanukkah. The events that took place were the few against the many, the five Hasmoneans, that the Maccabees that had conquered the enemy. And interesting, though, the miracle of the oil was something which took place after the military success. And we had plenty of cases in history, in Jewish history, where God rendered miracles. However, those miracles were in order that this, you know, the success over the enemy would take place. For example, the Jews going through the Red Sea, the miracle of the Red Sea, the 10 plagues, the stones that God threw down from heaven during the Joshua's War, and you know, many other cases. Two mountains that had collided, and had one had a protrusion and one had an indentation, and the army that was the enemy of the Jews was in the indentation, in the cleft. And when the two mountains came together, they crushed the enemy, and the Jews then saw the blood that had come out of the walls of the mountain and realized what had taken place. Again, this was all, you know, all these miracles, these numerous miracles were for the success. So we want, you know, for the military success. So we wonder what the nature is of the miracle of the oil having to last 8 days, because we have a principle in Torah that a person who is in a coerced circumstance is not culpable. So if the Jews could not rekindle the candelabrum in the temple because the enemy had defiled the oil, it was not their fault. So for God to make sure that the oil was miraculously lasting those 8 days until they pressed new oil, it seems to be it's not something which was necessary in terms of any type of, you know, removing the an exemption from the Jews. The Jews were exempted already because it was not their fault. And that's the case everywhere. So that's an interesting case. That the, you know, for what purpose was this miracle essential. Okay. And also the nature of the miracle, too. I mean, God designed the miracle, so there has to be a tremendous amount of insight, the structure of the miracle, and the actual object that the miracle took place in was the candelabra. Well, what's the meaning behind that? Okay. You have an interesting case also in connection with King David. And there was a point in history where King David saw that he was living in a palace of a house of cedar, a house of wood, very sturdy, beautiful palace. And he looked and he saw that the Ark of God was just residing in curtains. And he expressed this to Nathan the prophet, and he said those exact sentiments. I am in the house of cedar, and the Ark of God is in curtains, meaning it was unfit, that there should not be a greater beautification of where the Ark was housed. And Nathan says to David, do what is ever in your heart, meaning he was condoning what David said, and Nathan was a prophet, and he was condoning David's sentiment. But then that night, God gave a prophecy to Nathan and said that you should tell David two messages, basically. One message was, he said, will you build a house for me? And God continues and he says, from the time that I took the Jews out of Egypt, did I ever ask for a house to be built? That's one statement, he says. And another statement seems to be totally unrelated. He's just talking about how he took David from being just one of the commoners, and he raised him to the status of a king. So we wonder what the first statement, at least, is connected with David's thought to build a house. And you see that Nathan as well agreed that was a good sentiment. And the fact is that King Solomon did build a house, and it is a proper institution. But you don't see any sin that King David did. Nonetheless, God rejects David from building the house. And although it talks about the fact that he used a sword and he bloodied the sword, I'm not sure the exact words offhand, but it talks about it in Chronicles when it recounts all these events. It does not say that over here. It does not talk about the fact that David had won many wars. And it talks here clearly about two sentiments, that number one, that God never asked of it, never asked for the house, and number two, that God had created David into a status of king from just being a commoner. So what are these responses that God is giving him? Why is it that King Solomon is able to build a house? King David's son, King Solomon was accepted by God to build a house, and he did. He built the first temple. And Nathan being a prophet, and he agrees with David's sentiment, but it ends up that he's wrong. I mean, it's a very odd type of something to read. So that's the second case that we have. Not in chronological order, of course, because that was the first case in terms of a temple. So you have King David and Nathan, and you have God's response, where he was rejected. We have to understand why. And then we have the events by Hanukkah. And then we have one other event, and that was by Zerubbabel, who was the grandson of Jehoiakim, the king. And he had a vision, and he was told through the vision by an angel that he should look and see in a vision. And what did he see? He saw a gold candelabrum, and then he saw olives that were being pressed by themselves. There was nobody there, but the olives started to become pressed. The oil came out, and it flowed through tubes into each one of the seven bowls that were on top of the menorah that hold the oil. And the angel asked Zerubbabel, what do you see, and do you know what these are? Do you know what this is? He asked him, which is interesting. And he says he doesn't. So then he is told by the angel in the vision that at the end of the vision he's told that it will not be that the temple will be rebuilt. This is talking about the second temple now, so long after King David and King Solomon. But he's told in the vision that not by military prowess and not by might will you get respite from the enemies in order to build the temple, but it'll be by my will, God says, my spirit. So he says, by my will. So, of course, we have to understand what's the nature of the vision and what is the message. But what we're going to try to do here is see if there's a parallel between these cases in connection with temple, and then to finally understand what a primary message of Hanukkah is. Because, it, you know, of course, Hanukkah, it becomes like a very, and it should be a very celebrated time. But the celebration in exile, where we are, a lot of times it starts to take on the characteristics of alienations, gift-giving, which is not really part of that. The gift-giving is really part of the three holidays, Passover and Shavuos and Sukkot. But that's something, you know, you're glad that the happiness of the day is being facilitated by gifts for the children, gifts for the wife. But you don't have the concept here of Hanukkah, yet that has become something which many people carry. But what I'd like to focus in on is looking at the exact texts and seeing what we could derive from it. Okay, so let me pause here. Now that we have at least the three cases described, see if there's any questions or if there's any suggestions that you have in terms of what you think some common theme might be.
So, Rabbi, just to clarify, the whole gift-giving aspect of Hanukkah is not really part of that holiday? It just sort of floated in?
Yeah, it seems to be absorbed from the Christian holiday of Christmas, which takes place about the same time.
Interesting. But gift-giving is part of Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkot.
Yes, that's something which is facilitates a happiness for the family.
So, typically then...
You could do it, but it should not be looked at as being central to Hanukkah or even being an obligation. There's nothing wrong with doing it.
Right, but going back to the other three holidays, then typically a parent would probably give presents to children and so forth on Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkot?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
That's correct. So the facts are clear to everybody?
I think so, thank you.
Okay, well, you see that all three cases were dealing with a temple. And in one case, Hanukkah, the miracle is not necessary. They won the war. Nonetheless, God rendered a miracle. And the miracle, you have to look at how exactly the miracle took place. What exactly was the nature of the miracle? What was the message by David and Nathan that David cannot build a temple? And God says to him that, did I ever ask for the temple? And also, you know, remind yourself that I had created you a great person out of a commoner. And you see that Nathan also made an error here. And that's recorded. It's very significant, that I think, that the statement of Nathan is recorded, because you don't have information put into the Torah unless it's central to the message.
And then, Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
So, when it says that, let's see, you, the vision of Zerubbabel, that it wouldn't be by military prowess, not by might, that you'll get respite to build a temple, but by God's might or will, couldn't that have been construed to be the sort of the hidden miracle, if you will, that the Maccabees were successful in a guerrilla war where they were severely outnumbered?
Two different cases. What would the connection be?
Well, in other words, the fact that it seems clear, and maybe I'm projecting inappropriately, but it seems clear that God stepped in a hidden way and helped the Maccabees to be successful so that... they weren't rebuilding the temple, were they? They were just recapturing it.
They were rededicating it, right.
Right. So, in the prophecy of Zerubbabel, that's not what that's talking about? They're talking about actually building it?
They're building it there, yes.
Okay, so those two aren't connected. Okay.
Well, there's also two separate events in history. Unless we, you know, we see clearly that there's some connection between the two events, I don't see that we should make a connection. Even though they're both about a temple. But ideas can be the same. There can be a primary idea which does run through the three, which I believe we will see.
Okay.
The question is to think about these facts for a moment, and now, you know, let us, ponder it a bit and see if there is something which is similar in all three cases.
Is it possible that it has to do with the fact that the building or rededication or whatever of the temple does not happen because man decides, but in each case we see God intervening to make it possible?
You just cut my class time in half. Yes. Yes, that's exactly the point. Exactly. But go ahead, show how you see that.
Well, okay, so in the first event of Hanukkah, we see that the military success seems clearly to have God's hand in it, so that the Maccabees were successful against the Greeks. Plus, I mean, we'll have to address the question of the particular miracle of the oil. That's still outstanding. But we see God's hand in the whole thing. With regard to King David, he wants to go ahead and build this thing, but God intervenes and says, no, maybe that you want to, but my will is that your son do that, and we can certainly, then we probably want to delve into why that is, but we see God intervening there. And in Zerubbabel's case, I mean, that's clearly what the vision is saying, is it's not going to be your military might or your prowess or whatever, but it's going to be my will that's going to determine when that temple gets built.
Right, exactly. The question now is why?
That's a good question.
You're correct. In all three cases, the step is accurate, and that is that in the connection with the temple of Hanukkah, so they won the war, but then God saw it necessary to reflect on the success of the war by showing a miracle, but more so, the miracle took place in something that had to do with temple, the candelabrum, the menorah. And then we see that by King David, exactly the same, that he wanted to build it. It was a good sentiment. However, there was an error there, and even Nathan the prophet agreed with David, which shows a very significant point, and that is that even a person who is a prophet does not have absolute knowledge. Certainly doesn't have God's knowledge. So a person can only assess the best he can in terms of, and he was not having a vision at this point when he spoke to David. This was prior to the vision. So of his own intelligence, if it was a vision, then any knowledge of God has to be absolutely true. But this was his own statement to David, and like Radak says, because he saw David as being a very proper individual, and he assessed that any intent of David would be proper. But sometimes there are areas outside of man's knowledge. For example, God says to Abraham, before the destruction of Sodom, he says to Abraham, he actually says the sentiment in the Torah. We're not sure if he's actually addressing Abraham yet, but he says the words, "Shall I keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do?" So then he discusses and he says that he's going to, the cry of Sodom is great, and I'm going to, descend, meaning get involved in human affairs, to determine whether they should be destroyed or not. And when Abraham hears that, so then he discusses the famous discussion, if there's 50 righteous, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. But you see that God said that if he does not discuss with Abraham, then he will keep it hidden. That's why the sentiment in the Torah says, "Will I keep hidden from Abraham what I plan to do?" That means there's a certain, tremendous area of knowledge that is outside of man's ability. Abraham could bring himself so far, but without this dialogue, Abraham would only think that the righteous will be saved and the evil will be destroyed. That makes sense based on intelligent, you know, based on human intelligence. He can arrive at that. But when God said that now I'm going to determine whether or not they should be destroyed or not, this now awoke Abraham to, there must be a new possibility here if God is engaging me in a dialogue. So Abraham now realized that perhaps there's another consideration that God might not even normally, typical, you know, exact, strict justice demands that the righteous are saved and the innocent are saved with them, but the wicked are destroyed. But perhaps now, even the sinners, the evildoers, can be saved from another consideration. So that's why Abraham started asking him, if there's 50 righteous, will you save everybody? Meaning the merit of the righteous, meaning the ability perhaps for them to influence the evil people of those five cities, perhaps that would be grounds enough. And God says, yes, I will save everyone if there are 50 righteous. And he goes down a number to derive new lessons from each one. So also in our story with King David and Nathan the prophet, even though he's a prophet, but recognize that he's not having a prophecy, so this is now his own assessment of David. Okay. So he assesses, and but he makes an error. And we see also in the vision of Zerubbabel that he is being asked, do you know what these are? And he says, I don't know. Why is that? What was the reason to elicit that response? Evidently, that is something which is divinely designed, that this conversation, the angel and God, certainly they both knew the responses of Zerubbabel, that he will say that I do not know. And at the end, God tells them that it will not be through military prowess or might that the temple and the rescue from the enemies will be commenced, but it will be through my will. So I am essential to the building of the temple. And the same thing by David. David could not come up with the idea himself and then create a temple. Why not? Solomon was able to do it. And the Jews by Hanukkah also could not rededicate the temple without God's hand in the miracles. So that's exactly the theme that runs through all three cases. Now the question is why? What is the concept in temple that would, if we formulate the question, we'll see the answer. So why don't you try to formulate the question?
We're thinking.
Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal.
Could it have something to do with the nation's relationship with God at certain points in time?
Go ahead.
It seems to me, I'll just take King David's situation. He was not supported at that time. Is that my correct understanding, or by the Jewish people?
Yes, he was. Sure. And Rosora is just asking why was it necessary to perform an extra miracle. I'm assuming in connection with Hanukkah, she's talking. But that'll be part of the answer, Rosora. So we'll get to that in a moment.
Well, it seems to me when you talked about with Avraham, with his dialogue with Hashem about the 50 and then the 40, that has a clue in it.
Well, I was bringing that up just to show that there are areas outside of man's grasp, no matter how wise the person is. And I'm just showing that is true by Zerubbabel, it's true by Abraham, as true by King David and even Nathan the prophet. But how do we formulate the question now? We understand what the commonality is, the common denominator from these three cases. We see they're all dealing with temple, and in all cases, like Doug said, that God's hand had to be involved somehow. But now we want to understand why. So if we just formulate the question that way, it sort of leaves us grasping for what the point is. It doesn't really lead us. But as Rabbi Chait said years ago, asking the question properly is 90% of the answer. And what that means is we have to use whatever knowledge we have and embed that into the structure of our question. So try asking the question. Since, again, what we're trying to understand is, yes, we do see that God's hand was involved in all cases of the temple, whether it was the building of the first, the second, or the rededication in the case of the Greeks by Hanukkah.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Would it be that maybe we need to turn the question around and ask, what would be inappropriate or missing if man were to do this all on his own?
Do what all on his own?
Build or rededicate the temple without any intervention from Hashem.
Okay, there's one more part to the question you have to ask, though.
Okay.
Meaning, in all these cases, we're dealing with temple, correct?
Correct.
So then what we have to ask is why this is improper in connection with temple and nothing else.
Okay.
We have to focus our question on something significant about temple, which is what Hanukkah is all about. And those other two stories. There's something in temple that warrants that this relationship where God takes a role. We don't have that when you're putting on tefillin. We don't have that building a sukkah or any other mitzvahs, any other laws. When it comes to temple, all of a sudden, now there's a concern that it must be God must have a hand in it.
Is it because the temple is kind of the abode of God's Shekhinah?
It's going to be an abode of God's presence. Okay, what would that have to do with anything?
Well, only because it's a place where God directly and regularly intervenes in the world, in a physical place. I'm not coming up with a clear answer.
Rabbi, it seems to me that temple would be, it's representative of God's relationship to the Jewish nation, and that is sort of symbolic to the whole world.
Right.
And if it doesn't come about as a result of miracles or God's intervention, it seems like that's incongruent then to the Jewish nation. How do I say this? Like working with God or in do you see what I'm saying?
Not completely.
Well, it seems like when the Maccabees took their stand, that was a real they went all out. That was a demonstration of their commitment to God.
Right.
And the rededication of the temple and all of that, it seems like that is a real demonstration of the alignment of the Jewish people with Hashem. That hasn't always been the case.
So what is, again, so why is it in connection with temple that God's hand must be, play a role in either building or establishing the backdrop for the rededication or for the building of it?
It just seems like if man built temple without that, it wouldn't have the same significance. I mean, the Jewish nation is supposed to be a light to all the other nations. And without that relationship, the temple wouldn't have the significance or the meaning.
Can I piggyback on what Cal may be trying to say?
Sure, go ahead.
Almost all religious approaches try to reach out to God. And so if man could do it all by himself, it's sort of like, okay, it's us reaching out and somehow influencing or affecting God. But the Torah approach is really God, maybe, if you will, reaching down to man. And since the temple is the place where that connection is sort of officially made on a regular basis, then the temple has to be built through God's intervention, not just by the will of man deciding, okay, we'll do it here and we'll do it now and then everything will work. Sort of like if I light up a circuit and flip the switch, or if I wire a circuit and flip the switch, it'll work.
Right. Okay. It's very close to what I was thinking. And it's true what you're saying, that in terms of the difference between temple and let me just answer Razor. Razor is just suggesting that it's a gift of God, so he must give it to us, so we cannot get him, we cannot reach him without his permission. Well, we do have prayer, Razor, so we can do that. We can initiate a relationship, and that's exactly what the rabbis teach, that the, you know, a person, actually the prophets teach it, that if you God says, if you come to me, I will come to you, so to speak. So we can't initiate that, Razora. But Doug and Cal are saying that in terms of forging a relationship, which temple is, so it seems to be Cal's term, incongruent to suggest that we can just create the temple and then assume that the relationship is there. I'm not so sure about that, because through our repentance, we draw close to God, so then the relationship is recreated again. So we can initiate the relationship, and that's exactly what God says we should do. When we come back to God, if we cleanse ourselves of the sins, so then he'll forgive us, and then that relationship is there. But I think that there's a primary element and a primary fundamental in Judaism that these three cases address, and that is addressing a danger which exists in temple. You see, by the golden calf, the Jews are trying, they didn't say, even Nachmanides says, that they did not believe that the calf was something which took them out of Egypt. No fool, he says, would think that the gold that was in their ears, and that they melted and molded into a calf, was responsible for the plagues and the Exodus. He just says that was a means by which they wanted to relate to God. However, the sin was in terms of developing a means of relating to God which was incorrect, which was developed out of human psychology, not out of real metaphysical truths. And Sforno states that the temple was actually something that was a concession to man based on the golden calf. Meaning, since man expressed this need to have some physicality in his relationship to God, so then God allowed temple to exist, but it's something which is a highly crafted structure, and the laws are very, very precise, and there's many of them, all for the purpose of not allowing man's religious or idolatrous emotions to be expressed again like they did with the golden calf. So the temple is something which is a controlled means of relating to God, but a concession at the same time. Now, the danger that comes up is exactly what we saw in the golden calf, and that is that there are wrong ideas expressed when man tries to relate to God of his own. One of those ideas comes up in Temple, and that is that we can do something for God. Many people say this. We do a mitzvah for God. We do that for God. But people even go to the point where they say heretical notions that it makes God happy or things of that nature. See, this is the real danger. The danger is that man thinks that he can do something for God, when exactly the reverse is the truth. God needs nothing. He does not need man. And as Maimonides says, we cannot know why God creates man. Asking why is attributing a motive to God. Motive is something which is human. So we have to be careful not to project any false ideas onto God, to say, well, God did this because. But once you introduce that word because, you're now heading down a dead end. So in temple, it's a very dangerous phenomenon, because in all of the laws, other mitzvahs, what we're doing is we're relating to a black box, a tefillin, or the strings of tzitzis, or a lulav, or keeping kosher. But the act itself is not where we are now bringing sacrifices to God. That's a dangerous thing, because now a person might think he's doing something for God. Now, if he builds a house, he might think he's building this structure for God. So what does God do to correct this? In all three cases, God does not allow a person to be the one who initiates this. David wanted to build the temple. It was a good sentiment. But since you initiated the idea, you cannot do it. Now, what was God's response to David? He said, did I ever ask of this? Meaning, David, you're originating this. I did not ask you. So that's the error. And even Nathan the prophet, since he was not having a vision when he commended David on his idea, and he says, do whatever's ever in your heart, but he could still make a mistake. That's why God says afterwards, he says, not only does he say to David that, did I ever ask of this of the people, but also he talks about how he took David from being a commoner and elevated him to a status of the king. Why does God say this in conjunction with David's wish to make the temple? What do you think? Why does God have to remind David that he made him into a king in conjunction with his response to David when he says that he cannot make the temple?
Is it because he's afraid David is going to get, sort of puffed up within himself about his own importance?
Nope. He was definitely a humble individual. He recognized
that. That's right.
I think what God is saying to David here is that I am the one that creates man and gives him greatness, not the reverse. God was hitting the nail on the head and trying to underline what the problem here is. You think that you can make a temple and it's for me, and you're doing something to in some level that is going to make God great. Now, there is a principle that we are to beautify the commands. But what God was saying is that the relationship is where I benefit man, not that man benefits God. So he just reminds him that I created you into a king from being a commoner. I benefit man. He's underlining that very sentiment to David. You see? David wanted them to create the temple, and it was even something which Nathan agreed to. And you see that the Torah records Nathan's response to let you know that the highest level person can still make an error, and to show you that this is an area where it has to come from God, not from man, even from the highest level man. So it records the statement of a prophet, and it shows you that, no, that's incorrect. This is really an area which God has to initiate, and perhaps it's showing you that maybe this was outside of man's reach. So there is no condemnation of David. He didn't sin over here. He did not do anything wrong, but there was an idea which now he had to recognize. And just like Abraham had a thought that only righteous people are saved and the wicked have to be destroyed, until God told him that no, even the wicked might be saved because of extenuating circumstances. But you would not know that, Abraham, had I not engaged you in the conversation, God says to him. That's why God says, well, I keep hidden from Abraham. God's telling us that in his Torah to tell you there are areas that man will not be able to penetrate through those curtains. Zerubbabel as well, he's being asked, do you know what these are? Purposefully. He has to vocalize the point that, no, I'm ignorant of what these things are. I don't know something over here. That had to be vocalized. He had to see, just as the reality is, that he does not understand how these olives are being pressed in his vision, and they're just happening by themselves. Evidently, that was something which was necessary for him to see. That vision was important for him to recognize and to embody with his perception that certain things can take place without man's intervention. And that's exactly what the end of the message was, that it will not be by military, right? It will not be by your efforts, but it'll be by my spirit. I will initiate this, meaning in terms of temple, it has to be something which I create for man. It is not for me. The danger is only in temple because that's where man approaches God. All other laws, man is really related to another object. But in temple, there's nothing else. The object of your activity is God. You're bringing something to him, so to speak. That's where the danger comes in. And building the temple, certainly, we're making this temple for God. So there's a danger there to think that there is some, that we are beneficiaries to God in any way. And that's impossible. Even Pirkei Avos talks about this idea that you cannot make anything into like a beneficiary of Torah. So the idea is, in all three cases, and it's beautiful how we see how the Torah is written, and it gives us clues in each area, but then we tie them together and we see the significance comes down very clear. It's one message. And the miracles of Hanukkah as well, when you want to reestablish the temple, no, that has to be through God. Don't think that you are now, meaning it has to be that we have to understand the temple is for man. It is not for God. When God says, build me a temple and I will dwell in it, of course God is not physically, he does not take up space. He's not on earth. It means to say you build it and I will express my relationship to you in this temple. But everything we do in life is for ourselves. There's nothing for God. And that's an idea which is infantile and has to be. Many, many people still carry this around. That's why it's such a fundamental. And we have to be careful not to feel in any way that we're doing something for God. And a lot of times behind that thought is the wish that now God will do something good for me. So that another idea comes. If you need something, certainly we pray to God that he should help us. But the very concept and the danger which is born out of a temple is to feel that we are benefiting God in some way. So therefore, you know, God is saying, I will take care of it. This is all for you. I benefit you, David. I took you from a commoner and made you into a king. And he tells Zerubbabel, you don't know what's going on here. I want you to realize that you don't know. Meaning to say that man is lacking certain information. So I will tell you now that information, that is that you will not build this temple through your own abilities. I'll set the stage for it. And the Jews by Hanukkah, you're not rededicating this temple because of your own abilities. I will create the miracle. So in each case, it's clearly shown how God is doing this for the sake of man not falling into that trap, and feeling that he's benefiting God somehow. No, God, in every case, makes sure the man sees that I am responsible for this. I created you, and temple is for you. It is not for me. Okay, let me pause. If there's any comments or any questions,
Rabbi.
Yes.
My understanding may be incorrect here, but I had the understanding that God's Shekhinah was with the first temple, but not with the second, and I was wondering how that related to this.
Not sure. Again, I think you mentioned that last week, and I have to look that up. I want to see exactly the verses. I can't really answer that. I'm not clear on that.
Okay.
I don't know I never recall seeing the, I'm sure it's there, if you're recalling it properly. I never studied that.
Is this then another case of the danger of the religious emotion?
Yes. That's for sure. And it has many permutations. But we see here, you know, it's not just one case, it's three cases. Three cases we have.
So, then are we still going to cover one question that's still outstanding to me, which is why, in the case of Hanukkah, was there the miracle of the oil?
Yeah, the miracle there was because that's what they started to, that was the first action of rededication of temple. So in the actual rededication itself, God made sure that you see that I'm involved in that.
Oh, I get it.
I'm not sure why they picked menorah, the candelabra first, or not repairing the altars, or the table of the showbread, or the incense altar, or so on. Though we do see the first thing that they did was then had intervention from God, and he imbued it with a miracle.
That makes sense.
Okay, so Razor, I hope that answers your question. And what you're mentioning also that it talks later in Chronicles about David, and because he was involved in he shed much blood. So why was that something which, you see, when he shed the blood, it was for war. It was right. He was supposed to be killing the enemy. But that's another aspect that David's fame had to be removed from temple, because temple has to be exclusively God's identity. And if you had such a fantastic warrior, they said that Saul killed his thousands, but King David killed tens of thousands, and that of course started the whole jealousy that Saul had, the paranoia. But you see how the people viewed David as being such a superior icon, and that was in connection with his military successes. So that itself could also be another contributing cause as to why David could not be identified with the temple, because people do have this hero worship. And that is not something which is part of Judaism at all. God is the only worship. God is the focus. I remember once we were doing some creation of a website, and Rabbi Chait had commented, and there were pictures of like Maimonides, you know, great people. And he says, it's not the man. It's God's ideas. So if you want to put down words of wisdom, that's good, but to put up pictures of people, that is something which is against the Torah's principles. We learn from people. We don't idolize them. So he's very careful that the focus should always be exclusively God. Alright, any other questions? Alright.
Rabbi, would that suggest then that the thing to do is on the walls of one's home is to have quotes by famous people rather than their pictures?
Yes, that would be the same thing. If it's not somebody, for example, you have a painting and you have some anonymous people, because the painting is just made up. It's not a copy of actual people, so it's just imaginary people, and they're sitting and they're learning. Something like that would be all right, because you're not pointing out any type of a personality. You're just showing an image of people studying, so that's okay.
Yeah.
And Rosora is asking, what is the similarities or differences, besides from sacrifices, between the concept of temple and the concept of a synagogue? Let's see, good question. Differences or similarities between temple and the synagogue? Well, I mean, they are very similar. We are doing the same thing. We are approaching God, and we're praising God. They did have praises in the temple as well. The difference is that we don't have the sacrifice today, of course, or the different forms of work. But in theory, they're really targeting the same thing, to recognize God, and to view as much greatness as we can by the priests, the Levites. They would sing songs of David, David's Psalms, So they're very much alike. So we have to be careful. We have to come away with the lesson that the whole world is for us. It's for our benefit. And all the praises and everything we do in Torah is not benefiting God one iota. He does not need it. The prophets talk about this. And we have to come away with a feeling of thankfulness for this. Number one, that He created us and that He gave us this ability to perceive His wisdom. And here's another opportunity to see His wisdom through the way He related to people when they were attempting to build or rebuild or rededicate the temple. And then, you know, that's what Hanukkah is really allowing us to do. They did not, the Greeks did not want to destroy the Jews per se. They wanted to Hellenize us, to make us give up the Sabbath and the new moon and circumcision, different things that made us stand out. They wanted to strip us of that identity. And when we were able to be successful and rededicate the temple and reestablish Judaism, so this is really a primary tenet of Judaism. God is doing this all for us in order that we have lives secure from our enemies, in order to spend as much time as we can recognizing the wisdom that He allowed us to see. So this should be the real appreciation that we have of Hanukkah.
Rabbi, this is Janice in Seattle. I have a quick question.
Yeah.
The idea of publicizing the miracle by putting the menorah near a door or at a window, is that aimed directly at other Jews that they should see it and be encouraged, or is it aimed to the non-Jewish world?
I would have to say to other Jews, because unless the non-Jews know what that is, I don't see how they're going to understand what these candles are for. But if it does benefit other people, then that's even more important. But since there's a deduction that needs to take place in order to know what this is about. So when we see tonight we light six candles, so we know something about the story. We know that there were 8 days of miracles, and that we're now in the sixth day. But since it's a proclamation, a publication of the miracle, so the onlooker must know the miracle in order to be reminded when he sees it. That's why I would say that.
Rabbi?
Yes?
It seems to me that for the other nations that may not know it, though, just having it there makes you ask the questions that then might lead you to the understanding.
That could, but I don't know if that is the purpose. Mm-hmm. That definitely is there. All right, any other questions?
None here.
Okay.
It's a very interesting idea, Rabbi. Thank you.
It's nice to see how it's really right there in the verses. It shows you how delicate you have to be and careful when you're reading the Torah. It's not written by man. It's God's words man's writing inspired by God's prophecy. So there's a tremendous amount of wisdom here. And like I mentioned a couple times before, King Solomon says in the beginning of Proverbs that if you dig for it like silver and seek it out like a buried treasure, then you'll see the wisdom of God. And the fear of God you will find. Because God gives forth wisdom, and from His mouth comes knowledge and understanding. So that means your attitude has to be that there's a treasure here and you're digging for it, like something which is without a price tag. But then he says two things. Because God gives forth wisdom, and number two, from His mouth comes knowledge and understanding. What are those two things? God gives forth wisdom, and from His mouth comes knowledge and understanding. So this means that God is the source of the knowledge. So that's why you should have such a excitement when you're about to learn and to approach it. So that's talking about the source is coming from God. So that's one major concept you must have when you're learning. But number two, it says from His mouth comes knowledge and understanding. What does it mean, from His mouth? That means from the articulated word, the sentences, the verses, the words that are used in the Torah, there's tremendous amount that you can derive. Like Rabbi Chait says, let the words talk to you. When you're studying, it's written in such a way, it's so articulated, and so perfect, with such an amount of wisdom that's embedded in every single verse, that if you have that attitude, and number one, you know it's from God, and number two, you know that the formulation, it's not just the source that's coming from God, but the formulation has tremendous insights, then you can derive a lot. All right? So with that, let me wish you all a good week. We're going to pick up again next week, same time, right? 11:15?
That's correct.
All right, so think it over. We'll put this online shortly, so if you missed any part, you could hear the entire class. It'll be under the audio page. And until then, I'll wish everybody a good week, and we'll pick up again next week, 11:15 Eastern Time.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Rabbi. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, good week to everybody.
And to you. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.